To Roots of the Right. We're up to episode 4. So this time around, we're covering Bronze Age Mindset by Bronze Age Pervert. And I'm joined as usual by the glorious band of folk in this wonderful sunlight. We've got Demok.
Hello.
And Bronzo again. How's it all going?
G'day, fellas. I'm very well. How are you guys?
Good, yeah. Not too bad. So everyone's read the book?
Yeah, I think we've all done our readings this time around.
I've never read in my life.
Excellent.
The audio book.
So kicking it off, I'm pretty excited about covering this book. It's been doing the rounds in terms of coverage of alt-right and dissident right ideas and types. Made a bit of a stir, hit the top of the ancient Greek history top books list on Amazon. That caused some feathers to rustle. So this book, BAP, which will be referred to throughout the show, Bronze Age Pervert, refers to it as an exhortation, which when I got my dictionary out, I found out means that it's basically one big call to action. So that's pretty much what we're going to be doing with the podcast. It'll be a little bit different to the previous reviews. We won't be going kind of blow for blow. And yeah, I suppose that's how we'll approach it, unless there's some sort of Fed post from BAP's content, in which case, obviously, it's just we're talking about it in Minecraft, right?
Absolutely, yep. As always.
In Minecraft, yeah. In self-defense, and imaginarily.
Yeah. So from there, if you go and try and buy this book, which I thoroughly recommend everybody does right out of the gate because it's well worth your time, but you might find it on Amazon, and on the Amazon description, I think it'd be a good way to introduce the book itself. So I'll quote from it. Some say that this book, found in a safe box in the port area of Kowloon, was dictated because Bronze's pervert refuses to learn what he calls the lower and plebeian art of writing. It isn't known how this book was transcribed. The contents are pure dynamite. He explains that you live in Ant Farm, that you are observed by the Lords of Lies, ritually probed. Ancient man had something you have lost, confidence in his instincts and strength, knowledge in his blood. BAP shows how the Bronze Age mindset can set you free from this iron prison and help you embark on the path to power. He talks about life, biology, hormones. He gives many examples from history, both ancient and modern. He shows the secrets of the detrimental robots, how they hide and fabricate. He helps you escape gynocracy and ascend to fresh mountain air. The pricing, he insisted on, against all advice, it refers to the lucky 969 movement of Burma, led by the noble monk Wiratu. Praise be to the pervert. Praise be to his teaching of peace. Be careful. End quote.
Unfortunately, we couldn't get Wiratu on this week. He's hard to catch.
Yeah. I think that just a point, I was struggling not to laugh even reading that. Like, this book is genuinely, genuinely funny. I don't know if you're, how your mileage went with that, lads.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It is clever. It's covers some pretty interesting topics. It is also, yeah, it is funny. But it's also like written with like great artistry. It's like it was the whole package. It was like a really fun book to read. I would highly recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, definitely a page turner. Also, much like last week's book, I also read this one in the author's voice. I recommend his podcast. You'll listen to it once and you can't not read this book in his voice, a lot like Mosley.
Yeah.
The broken Russian accent.
Yeah. They referred to him before the record as the son of Slavoj, if anyone recognizes that name.
Zizek.
Yeah, we'll drop. I think BAP wouldn't mind. We'll drop a bit of his podcast in this just to give you a taste. If you haven't checked it out already, it's called Caribbean Rhythms. And it's fantastic. We'll obviously link the show and the other stuff for his content in the show notes. But yeah, I think we'll drop a sample of his podcast in and you can have a listen.
Welcome to Caribbean Rhythms with Bronze Age Pervert. I have listened to you and your complaints regarding my voice and delivery. I believe your complaints, the few of you who have said so, are entirely xenophobic and based on the fact that I am Russian and you are anti-Russian. If I had come here and spoken with a Bakongo accent or something like this, you wouldn't dare to complain. But because I speak like a Russian man, you say I must change my accent. Well, I listen to my audience, and I have started to take crystal therapy, speech therapy classes, and slowly I hope to improve my accent and my delivery for you. Meanwhile, I had on my mind Angola. Why I talk this? You know, from my travel, I know such useful information. Like, for example, where in Lisbon you can buy a map of Angola. Well, it's in one of the downtown subway stations where gentlemen from Angola used to congregate in bowels of the city, like bushmeat hawkers in Kinshasa markets. They come there in groups along with Moroccan hash dealers and also a deformed man with elephantitis, whose visage still horrifies me after many years. I wrote a letter of protest to the city for allowing this on the street. Allowing this is cruelty to that poor man and also to passers-by. Why am I telling you this? Because in this show, I was going to talk about Angola, and you may fairly ask BAP, why do you waste our time on one of the holes of this world? Why not talk, I don't know, Ficino's Resurrection of Platonism, or discuss Stephen Runciman's book, The Last Byzantine Renaissance, and no, I am not just being a snob dropping obscure names. I mean to discuss precisely these and such things on future shows. It's very important for my message to you. But what are such things made by dead old white males, they say, compared to the iPhone, also designed by white males, but now with some subcontinental contribution? But isn't this what we are told, that the iPhone is a greater achievement than medieval cathedrals? And if that is so, why not also Rwanda? Yes, Rwanda, the capital of Angola. Did you know it's the most expensive city in the world? But that must surely mean, if you ask Cato Institute, or maybe the propaganda martinets of the Koch brothers, that must mean Rwanda must be one of the heights of history, given that it is the most expensive city during, obviously, the greatest time ever for mankind. Well, I will explain how this all came to be, and you will also see why shithole like Angola is more relevant to your life today than you imagine, more relevant than you would like. But given that this has been a very high energy week full of chaos in the news, let me address first some recent happenings.
So what are the sort of broad influences on this book, lads? What do we take away, or who do you think is kind of in his ear?
For me, I think he makes it pretty clear who his influences are throughout the book. Because he doesn't kind of discuss his philosophy completely just from his perspective. He references his influences. So he mentions Nietzsche a lot. Houellebecq gets it kind of hinted at there. Spengler is mentioned. Schopenhauer is mentioned. He draws heavily on Greek philosophy, Greek theology, Hellenic philosophy type thing, and seems to have a lot of respect for the kind of Greek paganism and the Greek heroes, myths and legends. The other things, of course, are weightlifting. He's an aspiring nudist bodybuilder, as he claims on the back.
From the Twitter bio, very good, yeah.
Yeah.
an anti-xenoestrogen activist.
Anti-xenoestrogen activist, exactly. But this is actually, like, at first this is just seems like a funny joke, but it also actually is something that's really at the core of his philosophy. And it's also at the core of, I think, why he might also respect and name drop Camille Paglia. He has this appreciation for beauty, and I think in his sense of what it is to be a nudist bodybuilder, it's not in a sexual way. It's not in an objectifying kind of, sexualized way. It's simply about the beauty of the human form at its peak, at its most efficient. So, those were the kind of things I found throughout the book.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think that probably the one sentence summary for me is that he's somebody with a really disarming intellect. And whilst you're sort of laughing and thinking, oh, that was really, you got him, you don't realize that there's a lot of meaning behind that that's packed in. And as you read further in, that's hinged upon the fact that you've, I guess, laughed and you've sort of been opened up to that new understanding from that. I kind of saw it several times where he'll be introducing something that's a bit awkward or interesting, or he'll refer to a historical thing or like a concept and do it by first like dropping in something shocking or really funny and then sliding other stuff underneath it. And he sort of really makes you think. That the nudist bodybuilder thing, or the handsome Thursday that he does on Twitter, posting pictures of, excellent physique, is a good example of that. Because, you're right, he's talking about, I guess, the human animal at its peak and what that represents as a freedom and a vitality or a vitalism at its highest, and that being a virtue into and unto itself.
He definitely... the beauty of power, like wild human wild kind of masculinity, definitely a theme throughout it, and I think that's what kind of predetermines his views. You can almost pick them on religion, liberalism, not so much Darwinism. That was one that somewhat took me by surprise. But also on, woman, barbarism, and science as well.
Yeah, he definitely has interesting takes across all of those topics or all those themes. The Darwinism and the biology thing I felt was, really particularly interesting and well worth reading through for yourself. That's mainly, I think, in sort of parts one and two of the book. But yeah, he's got some very interesting ways of reframing your thinking about biological realities, which our guys are usually very good at diving into. So I think there's plenty here to engage with.
Yep, absolutely.
So from here, we might do a bit more of a deep dive into the parts of the book itself and kind of go through. So there's four parts in it, and we'll name them as we go and try and give you some good takes. But I think the key thing here that we're going to compel you to is, get a hold of the book however you can. Try and get Bab some money, obviously, for it. And, yeah, it's well worth your time.
Absolutely. All right, are we getting into it?
Yeah, so we've got part one here is titled The Flame of Life. So broadly in this, he talks about that, you know, struggle for existence, life and its bounds, what is it, why are we here, hormones, that sort of good stuff. So life, Damok, what means?
That's a big question. Bab does offer an answer, though, in some of his... One of his interesting takes, which I quite like, was that ultimately life is a struggle for space.
Mm.
Which he sort of illustrates it before he outright says it with lots of examples of animals and how they behave in the wild. And also a lot of pretty good, pretty funny disrespect to biologists and modern scientific methods, which he reckons misses the point. Darwinism is a theme, and he shares ideas with it, but he disavows the actual complete Darwinist mindset outright.
Mm.
When he comes up to his approach to it was basically that Darwin's view was skewed because he was from industrial England and was observing animals under extremely specific circumstances. His case basically being that Darwin only looked at stressed animals, so he thought, yeah, all they do is they just live and reproduce.
Mm.
But that's really, that's not, it's a bit sad to say that's all of life, even just for animals.
Mm.
What he was looking at was animals that were trapped and applying it to English life too with the people around him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he sort of tries to compel people to look at all existence or life in more of a natural state. Like, look at the role of hormones and the role of the will of the individual in these things. His concept about talking about, you know, all of us, animals and men included, living under owned space, sort of civilized or suppressed, oppressive territory in which, you know, Age of the Conquerors seems to have passed us, and we're now just seeking in different ways to survive. And yeah, it's an interesting sort of a bit of a black pill as a thesis, but it's very interesting when you start to think about it. It's almost a call to reconsider your own role within that. So I thought that was quite interesting. This sort of his comparison or analogy of such people who are comfortable with that state as yeast people. That was a bit of a laugh for me.
Yeah.
Talking about the blob humans.
Like he does have these two concepts of life, doesn't he? He has the yeast people, which is obviously it's kind of the most base form of life, the lower world form of life, which is it's for the sake of simply existing and continuing to exist, survival and reproduction.
Mm.
And then he talks about life with the flame of spirit as well, which seeks to develop its what he calls inborn powers, or so, you know, natural potential, I guess, is how you could understand that. And to pursue life for the purposes of glory and honor.
Mm.
And that's kind of where I see his idea of owned space come into play, because he takes a kind of Spenglerian position of collective freedom, which is people securing their own space in which they can pursue greatness. Of course, Spengler kind of made the argument that nature has predetermined that Western man will expand in space infinitely through conquest and travel, needing to own more and more space. And this is kind of like what he sees as a glorious path. But he also, at one point, diagnoses how there's not much unowned space left for young men or boys to learn the how to compete in the struggle for space. Did you guys
find that? To form gangs, I think he put forward,
I did have that quote actually written down somewhere, but I don't have it at hand at the moment. I do. There are no nooks and corners where boys can form gangs, be away from prying eyes of parents and others, and have the feeling that they are exploring and owning their own territory. Is what he said. So,
yeah, I thought another interesting part from another interesting sort of concept from this part was him talking about the sort of underbelly or sort of underworld spaces that represent unowned space or still chaotic spaces that are left behind. So places without law, typical underworld figures, nightclubs, prostitutes, the rest of it, organized crime stuff. It's really interesting to the juxtaposition. A lot of his sort of high classical Greek references juxtaposed with talking, hanging out with prostitutes in the back of Lebanese bars and stuff.
Yeah, I think he talks about, I think, going for a walk, doesn't he, in an area like that, and he says there's crime, but most of it isn't violent or something like that. But he seems to indicate that he feels stifled in anywhere that's owned space, that's not space where he can make it owned by himself, or at least potentially make it owned by himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get where he's going there, because you ever just get that feeling that there is only so much you can do? Like you see someone, like it's always an epic meme online where you see someone do something just really, really fucking weird.
Yeah.
And then you like joke and go, oh, yeah, this guy's powerful. I wish I was like him. Like, I don't know what his...
That's a really interesting point.
Example, but
whenever you see somebody like drop a massive burnout at the traffic lights after they've changed, or somebody who's just Bap talks about daytime drinking as a great idea.
Just pretty based.
Yeah. Just seeing guys like that just sort of shit faced at 1:30.
Yeah,
I'm definitely not advocating for that. But in context, if you read in the book, you see what he's getting at.
There is a freedom to that, isn't there? Because it is, particularly in his kind of Hellenic understanding of freedom, it's not being a slave to what the expectations are, particularly in that example where you're expected to not be drunk at 1:30 in the afternoon or whatever. But, you are, in a way... choosing death over slavery. To imbibe chemicals in that quantity is, in a way, a kind of death pact.
Yeah.
If you will, or can be seen as that. So.
Well, strikingly, he talks about the fact that chimpanzees only masturbate in captivity.
That is an interesting one, isn't it?
Big tip in the nofap column. And
so if you're trying to do nofap, I think the hint here would be the secret is to go to some really seedy, dirty underworld, third world city in like Southeast Asia or South America and just become a gang lord. You won't feel the urge to jerk it anymore. That's only half joking. That's a great nofap method.
Right, so we've solved masturbating. What about science?
Yeah, he seems to have a disdain for lab coats.
Yeah, not keen.
No. Well, I think I found that he saw their understanding of things as being, I think he places more value on merely the observation, learning through observation and understanding through observation. That's what I found. But I could have interpreted that wrong. What did you guys think?
Well, one of the more interesting takes I think he had was that all great discoveries were ultimately intuition, what one of the great minds just sort of felt, and that everything we're told is science, all of the stuff with experiments and mathematics and all of that procedure and peer review was just how they expressed it and proved it rather than how they actually came to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which you wouldn't know from, you know, watching the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, true.
He talks about the cargo cult of it, of the people who go, I love science so much, I'm going to go on Reddit/r/science to talk about science and watch Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, that is a...
These people, cargo cultists.
Yeah, I think there are plenty of people that are around our traps that are at least scientifically literate, if not, you know, actively working in some of the fields and would understand that. You know, you maybe came through it by being interested in sort of more popular science and communication stuff, and you definitely get to a point, well, you should, in my opinion, where you're examining what does it all really mean in context. Like, are you really interested in the actual practice of science, or are you just like dead keen on science for its own sake and what some people call scientism? So I felt that there's a pretty valid criticism to make here, even if he's just maybe tongue-in-cheek, or maybe not, maybe he's bang, you know, he's saying exactly what he means, that observational science, or things that you can sort of see for yourself and watch how it plays out in things like animal behavior or whatever, is the only thing that matters. I think there's something to take away from that.
Yeah, I would say I think there is a value in science. I think to completely brush off science is ridiculous. I've said that before as well. So I think somewhat an aspect of that is hyperbolic. But I think also a point that he gets at is that you can almost find a direct correlation where while our scientific knowledge has expanded and become greater, the regular people living in our time, their sense of human nature, or their understanding of human nature becomes more inferior in comparison to that of the previous generation. So it's like as scientific knowledge expands, understanding of human nature decreases. I think that's kind of something that he hints at as well, with that science might not necessarily actually add anything to our existence, anything to our, you know. And I think this might lead into the fact that perhaps he finds spirituality in a way something more valuable, although I believe he calls the soul gay.
He does, amongst many other things.
Fake and gay. Also, he didn't he disavowed science in its modern state, but he didn't disavow science. In a few places he talks about rediscovering the true science, which from what I've read seems to be hinting more at a more intuitive approach as opposed to a procedural one.
Yeah.
One which is, takes a bit more brain power to make the conclusion rather than Excel table upon Excel table.
Yeah. I suppose a more passionate science rather than a clinical science.
So not to get trapped in the weeds of one fake and gay topic, let's move on to another one. So artificial intelligence, is it fake and gay, DeMarc?
Yep, those were my exact words in the thing, because I agree with Bap there. Artificial intelligence is a pretty big meme. Not to dox myself, but I've done a little bit of work with it.
Right.
I don't think Skynet or anything much trickier than Cleverbot is anywhere near.
Like, what I really want to see is one of those movies where the AI goes crazy and ruins everything. But the AI is just dumb as hell because it's an actual AI. And it has weird bugs and behaviors, which you wouldn't intuit because it's a huge complicated mess. And it draws conclusions with really autistic logic and doesn't actually have a personality. And consciousness uploading, also a huge meme, and I've agreed with Bab's take on it for years. You're not uploading your consciousness, you're just creating like a shitty real doll of yourself.
Mm. Yeah, the ship of Theseus story, I'm sure Bab would get that, if and when he listens to this. Yeah, where they talk about, you know, if you start to repair a ship by replacing pieces of wood, at which point does it become a new ship? And you can. No, at which point does your AI clone become just a sex toy?
Yeah.
If you were to go through your brain and replace each neuron with a wire, so where's your consciousness.exe stored then? How do you control C, control V it?
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the go? Young and beautiful people, that's where it's at, right?
That's where it's at.
Yeah. Holding up the book. Yeah, young and beautiful people reading Bronze Age Mindset on the beach.
Yeah, and then sending the photos into Bab's wonderful channel. Is he at Bronze Age Mantis? Is that it?
Yeah, that's the at.
Yeah. So beauty loving, tanning good, bodybuilding good, book good, science, AI, gay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could get retaken and made cool again.
True.
Cool.
Yeah, sorry, where were we up to there? We were up to...
We're kind of coming to the end of part one. Did you have any other takes on that, lads?
I think I've said everything I have to say about that kind of section.
Well, he has a few, and he does disavow Evola later, so he might not appreciate this, but I've noticed some of his takes sort of similar.
Mm.
He has a similar conception of the ancient Hyperborean Atlantean people doing the north to south and west to east migration. Similar ideas about reincarnation. Cyclical time, I think he hints at a bit.
Mm.
So quite a few interesting sort of aligning to Evola. I'm not going to call them Evolan because he's clearly quite distinct and different and not a traditionalist in every sense.
Mm.
Similar ideas about the Greek gods being ancient forces.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much part one from me. We didn't have too much further. We can move rather nicely on to part two, which is titled The Parable of the Iron Prison. So we think in our notes here, you said we're all Jack Russell Terriers digging an apartment carpet. I really like that because that's one of the things that I remember from it. So if you kind of think about it a little, you know, we're all living these lives in modernity, may or may not go with our nature. Obviously a Jack Russell's pretty active little thing. It's going to want to be out there and digging and burying and doing Jack Russell shit. But yeah, it's hopefully hard to do that in a 12 floor apartment. What did you guys take from from those sections, Bronze?
My overarching take from this kind of chapter was, I think he does hint at the cycles here in this section, by the way, as Demok was saying before. And funnily enough, the cycles that we brought up when we were talking about revolt against the modern world, like the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, silver and gold, which are all characterized by a trait represented by that metal. And I think he describes the Iron Age not in quite so specific words, but as being a modern prison which crushes out heroism, masculinity, and also I'm going to say biological superiority. I think he calls it something else, but I understood it to be the strong kind of being, well, more so the, like in a technological modernity, he sees the weak as conspiring to mitigate the strong and to restrict the best, the superior, from achieving glory.
Yeah.
I'd imagine conspiring is the word Bap would probably use. He might have used it more than once in the book. One of the more interesting things he wrote for me was how the origin of the trap being somewhat the same sort of sense that any of that I'd imagine most of our listeners would have that something is wrong, and not quite reaching the same conclusion, but getting the feeling that that sense of wrongness was because they're not in thigh high socks right at the time. So that was an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, traps read Hegel. I see you've noted down there, or Hegel, however you pronounce it.
That was a direct Bap quote. I've neither read Hegel nor worn thigh highs, so I'm not an authority to really say much on that entire take.
I did buy a Hegel book once, and I'll say it was very difficult to read. It was very dry. But his Hegel's conception of freedom, I think, seemed to kind of influence Bap's conception of freedom, as I think Hegel's conception was about accepting the paradoxes of life and accepting reality, and I found that kind of Bap explored that in his understanding of freedom, in individual freedom at least.
I believe that in context, that was in line with him saying that they understand a lot of the same things we do intuitively, and hold quite a lot of the same worldview, but then just sort of go off somewhere else entirely.
Yeah. So when he he talks about freedom, moving on to talk about civilization, it's quite interesting. He talks about modernity and the modern city. There was a lot to unpick here. So modern city, you know, spoilers, is the Iron Prison, or at least that's the tangible reality of it. Had some pretty interesting points here. It's pure civilization is a Chinese slum.
Yeah.
Where did you pull that one from, Demok?
Well, he goes off about Eastern civilization versus Western. Opening with Eastern, and ultimately this is pure civilization. You just live your yeast life. You sleep in your pod. You eat your bugs. And it's just loud, cramped, dirty, a huge mess. His take is basically this is all of the East, and he doesn't exclude Japan in this. So weebs on suicide notice. I'm pretty sure this take just dunked on Nick so hard he couldn't make it tonight. They've got women dominating everything, like overbearing mums and stepmums. In-laws, that was what I meant. Getting allowances from the wife. And then this is what ultimate pure civilization is. And the Western cities, which are much nicer, at least in a few respects, aren't purely civilized. A little bit of barbarism, or at least freedom for the more powerful, and a little bit of barbarism for our upper classes.
Yeah. Our
upper classes still live in pod and eat bug. They are. If you're rich and well connected, you get to do your piracy.
So I had another interesting thing that I wanted to hit was I found his takes on environmentalism to be really prescient especially considering the Extinction Rebellion stuff that's going on and all that sort of jazz, and the current debates obviously globally about climate change and this target or that target or what we're doing or what we're not doing. It's a bit of a quote from part two. So I think this is, there's such short things. I'm not sure you call them chapters, but he's got numbered subheadings. So this is 39. He says, quote, "Some of the modern right wing is environmentalist and even beyond this, but mostly has contempt for the left greens and other half and half because they misunderstand the problem of civilization and technology. The problem of modern left is they seek not to defend nature, but to blame the West for the modern condition. And this is because the problem is said to be technological or civilizational progress as such. These people don't understand that the rapacious life, the bug life, is the default condition of mankind, and that the West, along with a couple of others, has attempted, since its beginnings, to try to mitigate the evils of pure civilization and to bring the benefits of free life within civilization as far as this was possible. The left environmentalist is not a reliable defender of nature. He's anti-racist first and cares for nature second. Actually, the two things are incompatible. China and India are by far the sources of the most serious, obvious pollution, which is the destruction of the world's oceans with plastics and garbage. The contempt for animal life is rare in India. Schopenhauer says it's for this reason that they easily rejected Christianity, because they heard of the gross mistreatment of animals in Europe at the time. But animal cruelty and abuse is exceedingly common, and the rule in China and most of the rest of the non-European world. It is only Indian and, today, European man that is moved by compassion for animals, who are our brothers and sisters." So the old environmentalism is fascism take.
Pretty common take. We see that one a lot. I think it's... I think you kind of see through his... that his perspective is that nature always wins. It's like maybe a way that I'd sum it up. And that's possibly why, because I don't think maybe he's particularly concerned with like making sure animals are comfortable or anything. Like, I don't think that's his philosophy, because his philosophy really is like just about strength and glory and things like that. But I think he has a respect for nature because he thinks nature is nature is glory. I think that's what you can kind of take from it.
Well, it does seem to me he likes to see animals dominating space, so I'd say that he does seem to have a bit of a message of kindness for animals.
Yeah.
I think there was an anecdote in here somewhere about seeing a caged jaguar and how depressing it was seeing it locked up in a zoo. And knowing it was locked up in a zoo.
Well, that's probably comes back to the chimps masturbating in the in the cage, you know, or in the zoo or wherever. It's them being having their inborn powers, their natural potential limited by, you know, potentially. Beings that are comparatively weak or womanly thoughts.
Yeah, and also put forward that you could see the chimp jerking it as a flex.
It's a pretty epic move, that's it.
But it can force everyone to watch it jerk off. I think Bap talked about
in Minecraft.
In Minecraft, I believe Bap was talking about doing the same power move in another anecdote when he was locked in the car in the shotgun seat with a shit driver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like
the times were.
Sorry, go on.
Go on. No. You.
My point was going to be ridiculous. You go on.
No, yours would probably be better.
I was just going to bring up that guy from. Do you guys remember? The Kony 2012 guy back in the day who his thing completely failed and was forgotten about, and then he just got arrested for masturbating in the street. It's like, in a way, that's a flex as well. It's like, yeah, all right, my thing was unsuccessful, but I'll still get attention. Here's how I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you so can always be forgiven.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, he's the Jack Russell digging in the carpet.
Yeah, I guess. guess when you can't dominate space, you still own the space on your dick.
That's true. That can't be taken away from you.
Yeah, even if that space is Coom Earth.
Yeah,
unless
yeah.
Unless you're American, then it just gets snatched up right away.
Yeah. That kind of it kind of encapsulates his idea of like death over slavery as well, though.
Mm.
It's like, even if not like actual death, you know, for Kony 2012 guy, for example, it is at the very least social death, which is kind of how, like, you know, social life is kind of the lifeblood of the modern human, for better or for worse.
I do believe that the French called the orgasm the little death.
Mm.
That was a bit of folklore, so I might need fact-checking, but interesting take. Maybe yeah. They knew about this whole thing, that they were aware that once you don't own space, all you can own is coom, so you've sort of just died of it.
Classic.
So he talks a lot about the, I think I've heard it referred to as, I don't know, Krytaki, could be a stupid word, but the sort of hidden powers behind things, cryptic government, etc. There's some really interesting stuff to dive into here. We don't have the time, but definitely check it out when you do read through part two of the book. Have DuckDuckGo up, I'll just put it that way. So he talks about as well, it makes a pretty sheer claim here that you shouldn't really trust thoughts that come to you inside or don't come too easily. So, you know, regular walks, I suppose, that kind of thing. But obviously that puts you in a weird spot, DeMarc, because you wrote the show notes indoors, didn't you?
Yep, I wrote the show notes indoors, so just disregard my part of the podcast.
Yeah, and the other traps of modern life that he talks about, he kind of talks about the comparatively greater freedom that Middle Ages sort of English peasants had over us, you know, basically living in a state of being almost pissed most of their lives if they lived past 13 because they were drinking the beer that was cheaper and safer than the water. And, just enjoyed all the feasts of, you know, saying whatever it was and whoever had something on. And maybe he's got a point there. I don't know.
It's a pretty common
thing. Whereas modern life seems to have, yeah, many snares available for all of us, right?
Indeed. That thing about not trusting your thoughts inside as well, or whatever, thoughts that aren't outside, is a Nietzschean thing as well. And I can't recall exactly, so I apologize for bringing this up without anything to point to. But that is something Nietzsche discussed. That's as far as I can take that point. Apologies, but yeah.
No, you're good. Pointing out it's good.
Where are we up to there? Sorry, by the way, I kind of derailed at that point. I thought it would be better than it was, actually.
No, you're good. I'm keen to hear from DeMarc about his experience with the traps of modern life and how you reckon you'll get over it.
Yeah, he does go on a bit more on this about... like his example's much better than mine a minute ago, where I just sort of lost wording for it, but he lists traffic lights, just general norms, and specifically riding shotgun with an idiot driver. He was recommending dealing with that by just jerking off. I'm going to use that when my idiot mates are trying to drive now. They're just going to have to deal with it.
So he talks a little bit about the sex and other religious groups that he had sex with a CTS, other religious groups that he might, you know, sort of point to and have a predilection for. And talking about Gnosticism in particular and a, you know, strange sect called the Carpocratians. but yeah, I think that one of the broadest takes you had here was nerds lie. Trust no citations. And history has been rewritten several times over. I think they were all valuable takeaway points from this part. Yeah. And the, did you want to get into a bit of the Gnostic stuff or more stuff from that, Demont?
I'm not a specialist on Gnostics. I think the audience would probably do better just reading what Bab wrote.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he makes the case that the root of all of it is that they try to absolve God of suffering with their whole thing about having a demiurge, which made everything bad in the world.
Mm.
The greater creator, the real God, being good.
Mm.
And also that the ultimate idea was that all space in the world is owned by the demiurge. That ultimately their worst fears are being realized by all of the space slowly getting more and more owned.
Mm. Yeah, the other thing that I think he kind of, you know, in closing out this this part, he gets a bit of Ola again in talking about the fact that maybe geography's fake. we don't know what's at the poles. And yeah, Southeast Asia could actually just be South America, not sure. And then kind of comes back onto the reservation, takes the tinfoil off to talk about the noble savage myth, which is something that's always kind of irritated me. But it's sort of interesting takes that he gets there and what civilization or the real, you know, the civilized man in that, those societies are represent. Yeah.
What I liked from that was that of his takes being that the real noble savage were the Germanic tribes that fought the Roman Empire and were around the ancient Greeks.
Hmm. Yeah, so part two, definitely well worth a read. A bit of a holding up a kind of mirror to the way that many of us have to live our lives, at least in the shorter term, I'd imagine. Did you take that away from it too, Bronze, or did you have some other points there?
That's kind of summed up all the thoughts I had pretty well. I think you're best off reading it. You know, we can give a little bit of insight, but it's definitely worth having a read of it, and you'll take more away from it because it is a flowing kind of writing style that he takes. It's, you know, hard to break down much more than into these broad concepts, I think.
Mm. Yeah, the writing style I found was almost, you know, stream of consciousness. But like I said, the staggering intellect on the guy, if this is stream of consciousness, the amount of references and different source material and really disparate resources that he draws on to make his points is just incredible, you know? I learned a huge amount from getting through this book.
Yeah, same. It really flows like his podcast does too, the same way he'll jump from thing to thing with an aside and an anecdote in here and just keep going.
Mm.
It's a page turner, so you don't notice, but I think this was actually denser than Ebola.
Mm.
In a way, yeah. I think it, like his knowledge of particularly history, but also like even religious concepts and things like that is really, really strong. But I think also I don't think it really is just stream of consciousness. I think this book is actually a piece of art that's been planned and orchestrated very particularly.
Mm.
I think we see this in kind of the way that he uses misdirection as well, because he uses things that are clearly hyperbolic. And I think not intended exactly as they're phrased. And then he says things which are very much not hyperbolic, and they're very true. And I think he uses these kind of two aspects to like open the reader up to different ideas. He also says though that he's not ironic. So I think that's something interesting to take out of it as well. But I think the whole book is a planned piece of art, and it's like orchestrated very, very particularly. I don't think anything about this is accidental or, you know.
No, I think it's really deliberate. The person behind it really has their head screwed on. And I think, you know, the knowledge of, you'll move in the same paragraph from classical Greek history to geopolitics to pop culture, and be making sort of the same point, or it'll be a bit of a cogent narrative. It's quite depressing that in some of the reviews or takes that people have had, they just get him for, you know, dropping the articles in his sentences. Pretty often he just won't use, you know, connected, like the or what or whatever. But the real, I suppose the real meat of it, as you're saying, is, yeah, it's very carefully put together. And, you know, that use of misdirection, the use of humor and analogy. And there's no, I found, and some Spurg will prove me wrong and email us. And, yeah, please do email us. But I didn't find any cases where it was, like, ironic or self-congratulating or, like, sarcastic just for the sake of it, because he can kind of flex on all us, you know, low-functioning autist types. Yeah, it's really... I think you're right, Bronz, that we're not necessarily going to be able to do it justice in any sort of depth. It's really something where people, I thoroughly encourage you to go and read it for yourself.
And then read it again.
Yeah. So that's pretty much part one and two hit. That's about the halfway point. So we might take a little music break and leave you with a great track. Do you want to intro our break music there, Demok?
Yep, we're... This is a critique of Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. Walk you through it and then give our critical opinion.
Yes, so this way it comes under the fair use policy. So, yeah, it's by a guy called Warren Zevon. Fun fact, it was the last, it was the song that he played on the last live performance he ever gave before he died. There you go. But it's about, well, you'll hear it. It's a pretty wordy song, but a great account about a mercenary in the African Civil Wars. So, yeah, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. It's a real sing-along. We'll see you on the other side.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. Through 66 and 7 they fought the Congo War, with their fingers on their triggers, knee-deep in gore. For days and nights they battled the Bantu to their knees. They killed to earn their living and to help out the Congolese. Roland the Thompson Gunner, Roland the Thompson Gunner. His comrades fought beside him, Van Owen and the rest. But of all the Thompson gunners, Roland was the best. So the CIA decided they wanted Roland dead. That son of a bitch Van Owen blew off Roland's head. Headless body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. Roland searched the continent for the man who'd done him in. He found him in Mombasa, in a ballroom drinking gin. Roland aimed his Thompson gun, he didn't say a word, but he blew Van Owen's body from there to Johannesburg. Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. not the man.
Go in the headless Thompson gunner.
The eternal Thompson gunner, still wandering through the night. Now it's 10 years later, but it still keeps up the fight. In Ireland, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Berkeley, Paddy Hearst heard the burst of Roland's Thompson gun and bought it.
So, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, Demok, what a tune. But consistent with the fair use policy, we need to offer some sort of critique for this copyrighted material. I think we can do that.
Yeah, I think we can.
Yeah.
In the later parts of the book, across 3 and 4, it's a lot like the lifestyle Bap talks about the warrior, the free warrior, sort of ancient Greek mercenary sort of lifestyle.
Hmm. Embodied here by Roland, yeah.
Yeah, I might just add that I found it or rediscovered it through a pretty good cover by Lauren O'Connell that a mate showed me. So, like how the whole covering thing keeps the ancient way of oral history going. Same way that we do everything on audiobook because we can't read.
Yeah, being the literalist, I suppose my critique was there's a line in the third verse when it talks about the revenging Roland. I just might like to point out that it says that Roland, when he found the cur Van Owen and dealt with him, says that Roland aimed his Thompson gun. He didn't say a word, but he blew Van Owen's body from there to Johannesburg. So Roland doesn't have a head at this point. He didn't say a word. I get that that's a bit, it's good for drama, but it's also impossible. I think Johannesburg's pretty far away from Mombasa.
Yeah, that's a big shot. That's a
big shot. That's really unrealistic. I don't like the song anymore.
I think so. He becomes Roland becomes the headless Thompson gunner, doesn't he?
Yes.
After he gets his head blown up, he becomes a phantom. And apparently, he's wandering. He continues wandering through the night and haunts conflicts in Ireland, Lebanon, Palestine, and Berkeley, California.
Right.
Yeah. So pretty epic.
So he gets around.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you reckon he's in Syria now?
Definitely.
He's preparing to go at the very least.
At the very least, he's looking down the back of the couch for his passport, which is hard if you don't have a head.
Yeah, he'll be teaming up on the Kurds. The bloody Kurds will be getting wrecked by him.
Definitely feeling a decent, strong 8 on this track.
Ooh.
You're going to rate it an 8?
Decent to strong, so that's like nearly a 9.
Yeah, look, I like it, and I think because you wrote it with an actual Civil War mercenary, I reckon I'm going to give that this 7 Thompson guns out of 10.
Yeah, I'll give it a big thumbs up. That's all. I'll just give it a thumbs up from me. Pretty good song. Pretty good.
Magic. Well, I hope that our valued audience enjoyed it as well. You can check out the lyrics for yourself, and we'll now try and make the best of it and get through the remaining 2 parts of our wonderful book. So part 3 is, you can tell I really researched this well, Men of Power and the Ascent of Youth. And some very, very funny takes in this one, but he's talking about what would be the best kind of men to reinvigorate us all, and the state and political actors, and how they're kind of maybe a little bit different to what we've got now. Is that what you took away to start with, Demok? The role of the military state, how about that?
Yeah, he makes the case that the peak life is in the military state, like ancient Greece.
Mm.
And later on, he does actually tie this into mercenaries in the African War and conquistadors. So we did pick Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner for a reason.
Yeah, it all, I mean, obviously it was well considered decision for us. It wasn't just that we both were fascinated that we discovered the same obscure song and decided to feature it on the show.
at the same time, even on the same day.
Mm, what mean?
Yeah, there's something to be taken from that. But there's
a bit of synchronicity going on here. I read his part about ancient Greek hoplites and doing superhuman feats of strength on the same day that he discussed it on his podcast. Mm. So what means?
Big what means.
Big what means.
Yeah, very big what means from me. Pretty cool, though, this section. Pretty cool section three about the describing the epitome of life as being the military state of strong men. It's pretty fash. Pretty fash. Strong brothers achieving great feats, and I suppose this is where we see his idea of piratical bands of brothers roaming the countryside.
Yeah, he writes at length about how the strong form of like a brotherhood of friendship, the ancient Greek conception of friendship being gone, which I don't completely agree with. We've got some pretty good lads down at the pub down here.
Hmm.
But it is disappearing bit by bit as you live in your pod and you eat your bugs. You don't quite come across those sort of brotherhoods so much anymore. You've got to work for them.
That is true. It's rare. And you also don't get even things like... you don't get it as commonly as you used to. Things like just mentorship from like the older generation and stuff like that. Which is something that's not really discussed here, but it is, I think, relevant to the idea of life in a military state with strong brothers.
Hmm.
He also kind of... I think I mentioned this earlier, but he diagnoses our condition today as pure slavery. I don't actually think this was in this section. This is just a note I have, but it is relevant to the point, so I'm going to say it anyway. He diagnoses our condition as pure slavery due to our submission to what he calls abstractions, such as human rights, equality, and the people, which is kind of like when contrasted with like life in the military, those things aren't... they are a little, but they are a little these days, but not so much. Like the military... your submission is more so to things like strength, service, camaraderie, things of that nature, which is obviously things he values. When he talks about like the great tribes, Spartans or the Germanic tribes, he talks about barbarians even.
Hmm.
He does. He doesn't mind the barbarians at all, really. Seems to be quite a fan. In the context of the ancient Greek life, I think is reiterated in not just part three, but in earlier parts too, I think, about how the civilized ancient Greeks would occasionally do a bit of walkabout and go join the tribes, the name of them for a bit, go wild for a little.
Yeah, he also talks about, if you're talking about the kind of band of brothers in the military state thing, talks about the notion of friendship that we don't really see as much in the world today. Friendship that was capable of limiting desire for conquest, and able to increase harmony within, you know, the state that one represented. So I think it's sometimes called or referred to in the same sort of sentences as the Greek, ancient Greek concept of philia. He talks about this Greek friendship and the concept of, you know, training partners and other blokes and manabuns or whatever you might call it. There's a quote here from 54 in part three. He says, "Greek friendship, You think maybe I promote the ruthlessness of a machine politician with tuna stay and brown sport coat, or a petty office intriguer, or catty interior designer with upward lilting voice who backstabs his colleagues to get contract. Fools, you think I'm here to promote a way of life or morality. No principles or ideas are of any use today. All will be retooled and taken over by people like these. Self-help is completely useless and not what this book is about. Rather, I would like most to go towards self-destruction and to be rid of them. I only care about very few who, being constrained in their predatory nature by this open-air zoo, must look to the past to understand what is possible. I want to give encouragement to some who are a certain way in their blood, and to encourage them to become the purifying hand of nature. So it's going back to the, you know, the themes from part two and that sort of stuff. It's pretty interesting. He keeps hinting at the central thesis and what he really means by his Bronze Age mindset. But this concept of the strong friendships and, you know, militaristic brotherhoods, yeah, it doesn't sound too bad.
No. It's a bit of a Bane post, that quote you just read. can you read that last sentence of it for me again?
I want to give encouragement to some who are a certain way in their blood, and to encourage them to become the purifying hand of nature.
Yeah, I'm just seeing Bane there saying that. Tom Hardy is Bane through his mind. But yeah, he does talk about these friendships. He also goes into the idea that in the contemporary kind of time period, men doing anything together aside from kind of activities allowed by their wives or mothers risk being called gay. Did you have any notes on that? Or have I jumped the gun on that section?
No, I think DeMarc might have.
Okay.
About, I don't think I have any notes on no homo. Okay. Most of mine was about his part about the brutality and plundering, because a lot of this chapter is him using historical example after example of generals and Greek leaders doing all sorts of, like, outwardly or pretty much straight up brutal stuff. There was a running thread between them of invading a city by inviting all the leaders in and, you know, just for dinner and then killing them all.
Yeah.
The one did it. He also made the great point that Obama says yes, because it's a campaign slogan. Yes, we can.
Yeah.
I really appreciated being called gay at several points of this part of this chapter. Because I'm not like, and I think some of the names that we had were Pedro Del Verado, Bob Denard, Colonel Mike, Mad Mike Hoare, and Capanius, or Capanius. Yeah, gay, because I'm not like them. These conquering individuals or men with their superhuman mindset, or modern day mercenaries in helicopters single-handedly mowing down hundreds of insurgents. It was a pretty interesting experience getting through the whole thing. But all of the people that he's referring to in the stories, this is one of, I think I referred to it briefly before, this is one of the points where I really found myself, you know, constantly creeping off to look things up and check it out and look at it in detail. And it's some really amazing stories that he covers here in pretty short order.
Yeah, it seems to be a running theme with our books that the more we read them, the more we realize we are, in fact, just gay communists.
Yeah, I think that's the danger of running a show like this, right? We're just horseshoe theory would say that we're going to find out that we're actually, you know, trans Latinx communists.
Well, I've been called a communist for things I've said before, but I wouldn't say I am a communist. Definitely not.
So his takes on piracy, or calling people towards it, and how that lines in with the Bronze Age mindset, this desire for conquering that we've all got in us, I thought was quite interesting. And similar, I guess, to the Evolan stuff of trying to think in a traditionalist or mindset that's beyond time. Bronze Age pervert tries to get you to think in a mindset that's beyond our conception of civilization or, you know, any sort of order or nobility, and then think into that mindset of the simple will to power and desire to conquer. So I guess in that way, it's, you know, he's flagging Nietzsche again, or echoing Nietzsche.
We just raid and pillage for the boys.
No homo, though.
It's no homo raiding and pillaging.
Yeah. So Bronze Age Pervert is very much, yeah, the boys.
Yeah, well, I think his philosophy, I've probably said it revolves around a whole bunch of different things at this point, because there's so many themes, but I do think his philosophy largely revolves around appreciation for the wildness and power that man is capable of. That's what is kind of like best embodied, I guess, by like roaming bands of men, pillaging and plundering with the boys.
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There is a wild, primal, you know, power to that. I think he seems to indicate that he sees the Indo-European kind of Bronze Age warrior caste as the most noble of the castes, even more so than, you look at when we discussed the Vola, I think he saw the priestly castes as the most noble, which was how those caste systems tended to see them. But I think Bap seems to, and this might have been, we spoke earlier about how he seems to have a bit of a disdain for Evola. Perhaps this is why, because he sees the warrior caste as the most noble. Whereas Evola saw himself as warrior caste, but saw the priestly class as the most noble. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I think Evola sort of dismissed the warrior caste as second down and said it was good, but, you know, only silver medal. Whereas Bap would see these priestly castes as the old men who bring about what he'd call the yeast society.
Yeah,
it's old men, old women, young women, everyone but young men against young men, basically.
Yeah, I think he kind of, you see, like all his the kind of characters that embody the most authentic expressions of societies are always the pioneering or the soldier kind of warrior characters. Like in the Americas, it's cowboys, the most expression of Americanism, and the Germanic tribes' piratical nature. I think that's what he means when he discusses piratical brands of bands of brothers.
Consider the
freedom.
Yeah, consider the broad scale appeal still, and the amount of cultural attraction in Australia of bushrangers.
Absolutely.
And I think that one of the reasons that it's got such traction is because people do look at it as this archetype of freedom and a rebellion against elements of society that were seeking to keep basically prisoners under, you know, arrest or oppression. Din head take in the context of BAP stuff, but yeah, it's interesting to know.
No,
it's
true though, and I mean, he might see bushrangers as being the most authentic expression of Australian, like, you know, Australiana or whatever. And
The Kelly brothers, I suppose, might have classified as, or qualified rather, as being one of the sort of classical friendships that he talks about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or the Kelly gang. Brothers, so there's no way that it could have been misconstrued as gay, which seems to be
an essential
part of having a male friendship. If you're you have to be
missed. That was one of our
academics. Like, they can try and they can reach. I reckon sooner or later you will see a paper about Kelly gang, gay sex ring, sooner or later.
It's pretty likely.
Yeah. Like queering the Kelly gang or some shit.
Yeah.
It's, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I suppose the Gerildery letter that Ned Kelly wrote, it's been moving around. If you haven't checked that out, definitely check it out, listeners. It's the Gerildery letter or Ned Kelly's manifesto before he went full Minecraft.
Actually, yeah, that train he tried to derail, it was a phallic symbol, so that showed that he was trying to free the sexual spirit.
Yeah. Either that, or he was, like, really trad, and he was trying to destroy phallic symbology. You can take it as one or the other.
Trans? Who knows?
Yeah, perhaps. That's an interesting take, actually. I had a note here as well that he's... Bap is kind of an accelerationist. He seems to advocate for not only Banzer Brothers roaming the countryside, but plundering cities of excess. Kind of echoes of a lot of accelerationist content or literature, which often brings up the idea of like a purifying fire or something like that.
Definitely shares sentiments there. I wouldn't call him an accelerationist though, because he does discuss, he conceptualizes the current state of things and the power that be is the Leviathan. I think he writes about that basically being doomed to collapse by its own flaws, regardless of what we do.
Yeah.
A lot of what he's writing is for when that happens or when its grip weakens enough that there is unknown space again.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to advocate trying to speed things up through increasing degeneracy. Although he does later on suggest weaponizing degeneracy and vice, but not necessarily in an accelerationist way.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says that in any of our efforts, I think it's earlier on in the book, any of our kind of efforts on this side of things or forming our own bands of brothers, and we're also going to need to, you know, recruit or actively seek out people who are able to move through, you know, the underworld pretty comfortably. We need scoundrels as well as people who are these upstanding, you know, Greek warrior types.
I believe on
you need the Aussie larrikin.
Exactly.
Yeah, on his podcast, I remember him discussing, was talking about some businessman from Africa who'd been basically using business stuff to plunder it for years. He finally faced jail, but only because he came on the wrong side of someone bigger than him. Saying we need people like this who know the real dark side, the blood diamond trades, the all the darkest parts of Africa and the third world countries to do that sort of manipulation, which is an interesting idea. I'd imagine a lot less pleasant to do than it sounds, but cool idea.
Yeah, I think that the kind of calls in this chapter and lots of the points that he makes, and there's a tremendous amount of history that he flags and talks about. But one of the main things, I don't know whether this is the point or what it kind of maybe says about me, but I found myself being maybe uncomfortable at how little comparatively I'd done that really is going to, you know, have a great deal of resonance or that sort of stuff. Or I was just thinking, you know, that classic meme about like born too late to explore the world and born too early for the boogaloo, but I've got a Nintendo Switch or whatever.
Yeah, well, it's not even feeling melancholy about how little you've done, but also how little you might do in total, or how little you will ever even have the chance to do, regardless of how capable you are of doing it. I think it's kind of all of those things rolled into one. Because there are... Sorry, go on, Demok.
No, I was going to go off on a tangent, so you finish yours first.
Oh, I was just going to say there is a... there's very little opportunity for people in modernity to pursue like the glorious or, you know, anything like what the great men that Bap lists off in this section. There's likely nobody from this time who will take a position like that in history simply because there's no way for anyone to. Like, war isn't waged gloriously anymore, and for people just working at home, they're just, you know, they're not really finding anything particularly revolutionary. They're just probably working in an office for 8 hours a day, and then they sleep until they go back to work again. So there really is no chance for anyone in modernity to become this embodiment of masculine energy.
Hmm. But you can definitely make efforts to approach it and that sort of stuff.
Just reading over it, like in a similar way to what you guys were doing, I was reading in the thinking to myself, in the context, would I be a cool enough guy to do what half of these things do in the context?
Yeah.
Because today, it may have been here, may have been part four, he was discussing how some of these more recent examples, like a lot of the mercenaries in Africa would do things like try and coup a country to make themselves a dictator.
Hmm.
And then get shut down by the UN in one way or another. So it's not as easy anymore, and we've got to wait for this Leviathan to lose grip before you can go do anything really outlandish.
Yeah.
So it isn't quite like it was then when you'd have a state behind you if you're an ancient Greek. Well, not a state behind you, but at least a brotherhood. And there wasn't such a big Leviathan trying to hold the holding pattern. But the other thing you got to wonder is, would you be a ballsy enough guy to test it to see if it's lost its grip yet?
Yeah.
I think definitely I'm not actually up for flying to Africa and attempting a coup soon.
Yeah. I think definitely these days it's like not even realistic, particularly in Western countries, like to do what these people did. And I think that kind of lines up with his concept of own space. It's like more space is accounted for, if you know what I mean. I think if you imagine it as like the more space that's accounted for, like the, I want to say dense or maybe tense, the more dense or the more tense it all is, the situation, finding it hard to put this into words, but that makes it more difficult to kind of conquer, if you know what I mean. That's to put it as simply as I can. Does that make sense, or was that just rambling nonsense?
I get what you're saying, and there's a reason Western countries, you don't do it. There's a reason all of the recent ones were, or the most recent ones, I think running up to like the 80s, were all in Africa for a reason.
Mm.
And even back then, the only examples from the West were Greeks taking other Greek states.
Yeah.
Mm.
All that space is owned, and like occasionally you do get a pretty top quality conqueror, and they'll be getting paid off by either a state or a military company, which would uphold this Leviathan, because you know you don't just do these things for free.
So the decline of the great conquering forces, bands of brothers, etc., but still, it's definitely a call to similar qualities in yourself and to examine those parts. He also flags some other historical stuff here. So talks about Caligula as being the first real ship poster. I mean, he did make... Was he the one who made a horse a senator? Or his horse? I don't know
about that.
Yeah.
I'll Google it.
And talking about the characteristics and the ways that men of power or with real influence kind of are distinguished. There's one part, and I can't remember whether he said it in this part or another, but he said that, ambitious people are losers, and you just simply need to be a winner or to act like a winner, and people will respond positively to you or treat you like you already are. I thought that was quite an interesting take when you consider some of the figures around today or in the past who have sort of seemingly done the same thing, you know? They might not have had a great deal of power to begin with, but they certainly always acted like they did.
Yeah.
So the in closing out this part a bit, he kind of takes us through some ways to influence popular opinion or some things that we should be doing. And it's bad news a little bit for us guys, because being podcasters, and he reckons that movies are the way to go. Did you catch this part, Demok?
Yeah, that bit, it is interesting because it's something I've been playing with, the idea of maybe dropping in a call to action, not necessarily film, but just trying to get our guys to do more creative expression and, like, I mean, real creative expression, like, not to talk it down, because there's been some great stuff put out, but a lot of what we do is overtly political. Where it's not really art as such.
Yeah.
Where I'm going with that.
Like,
racist Nazi covers of existing pop songs is cool and funny.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen a lot in terms of our guys putting out stuff which is just music that's music, or putting together most of our cartoons and comics also political.
Yeah, he says from the a quote from the book where I'm getting this from is in 61 part 3 says, quote, "The story of the heroic age of exploration remains to be told in full, and maybe one of you one day will make big book or big movies. I say also now, for those who seek to make a difference and have some artistic or visual bent, movies are the golden key to the minds of the many. What Mel Gibson does is worth 1,000 books or activisms for your side. Learn to make movies, if you can, and you can start with video."
I like it. I think that's actually a really good idea. And I also like his take that we keep remaking the Argo. The audio text is always in our memory.
Yeah, yeah.
That is interesting, and I think we should be trying to get those archetypes and those ideas and, like, the true getting a bit of health and beauty on screen is good.
Absolutely. I mean, good luck with it in many settings these days.
I'm not 100% on with his film takes. I actually like Joker, and I don't want to throw out a film for being dark or showing sickness, but we really do have a lack of proper health and beauty in stories which just uphold the actual values instead of trying to be a deconstruction of other films or explorations of gayness.
Yeah, I think we've seen culture move away from pursuing natural beauty and towards pursuing the ugly for whatever reason. And that pursuit of the ugly is now, like, really, like, quite ingrained in what I'll call Western culture, I guess.
Yeah. Veneration of the ugly and modernity.
Yeah.
And the marginalization and, you know, intense ringing in the face of beauty.
Yeah, exactly.
no, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of his thesis, isn't it? That, like, the beautiful and the strong is restricted by the weak inside technological modernity.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. So he gives some clue towards the boogaloo at the end of the end of this part of the book. And if you don't know quite yet what we're talking about with that, maybe this isn't the podcast for you, but you can definitely check it out if you go and search for it somewhere. But yeah, he reckons that it might not be won by the usual suspects, and that there's definitely going to be a significant role to be played by you know, some quite unusual suspects. You put your finger on it pretty well, Demok. What did you think?
I think his take was essentially that no matter what form the boogaloo takes, whether it be a slow catabolic collapse or, you know, just the sky goes dark and everyone starts fighting for no reason, you know, that surprisingly common take on how it's supposedly going to happen. Whatever form it takes, it won't be won by brown street gangs that run around and just cause havoc. It'll probably be won by white ex-military people. Probably I think this is a bit of a US take, but I suspect it'd be the US Marines doing well, no matter how you slice it there.
So I suppose that closes out part three for us, and we're coming up to what I found to be the most sort of moving and powerful part of the book, which is his sort of parting shots that he calls a few arrows. So we've got only a couple of notes to get through here, lads. What were your broad takes with this one, Bronze? Did you have much?
I had a little bit. I think he kind of introduces it as diagnosing the West as infected with liberty or liberalism or liberation, specifically liberation of women in the 19th century. So I suppose he's talking about reasonably modern feminism. That's kind of my broad take. The West is infected with liberalism. So he discusses feminism. He discusses suburban life. And he discusses weightlifting, which is one of his obvious interests. So, what did you guys have on this section?
Yeah, he does really go off on the essentially giving women the vote, especially because that effectively doubles, or more than doubles, the number of people who aren't young men who are going to be voting against young men's interests when you're doing democracy. Both in this and in the podcast, he's talked more than once about how in a real ancient Greek democracy, the franchise essentially only went to hoplites, heavy soldiers, eventually later on the track, other military personnel and Navy people. But that was effectively restricting the vote to strong young men as a representation of the country's military force. And that the extension of the vote to women basically throws that out. It means that you're eternally voting into matriarchal old people and women yeast society policies. Eternally.
Yeah, I guess rather than railing against altruistic morality, you just end up getting to where we are now, which is strong men feeling guilty for being superior, and you end up rejecting the natural biological hierarchy that exists, under which I think is the argument here of Bab as well, under which like all great achievements are made, right? Uniquely great men who are left to discover things on their own, like how we discussed with science earlier, left to their own devices to innovate and to make things strong and achieve glory.
There's an interesting sort of framework here that he paints about the decline in modernity, and sort of paints feminism or women's liberation as being a reaction to and progressing through stages to just simply being a revolt against men that were undeserving or really shouldn't have ever been in positions of leadership and that kind of thing. And it's sort of this negative spiral down now where they're just losing respect, more and more respect progressively for the men around them. And it's something that we touched on briefly in some of the Evola stuff as well. It was quite interesting that he dove into it. I think that there are, not to be too, PC about it, but there are exceptional men and women in these cases, but neither can flourish in circumstances where they're being artificially constrained in their relations or in their abilities to undertake, roles that would be fitting for them. Yeah.
And sometimes I think this is the reason why BAP particularly focuses on the Bronze Age as a period and and a focus of this this kind of philosophy, I think brutality sometimes is like a necessary expression.
Mm.
I think that's what Bap believes as well.
I think it's he talks about it as like a threshing mechanism that clears away, you know, weakness and detritus and that sort of stuff from, you know, within and without societies. Whether I guess that's thematically or in Minecraft is, you know, you can read the book and find out.
Yeah. Speaking yeah. of, actually, our apologies to Napoleon Bonaparte, because he lifts him up as an example of someone like that, being a true warrior aristocrat emerging in the mercantile age. Also see our Avola podcast for more on mercantile age stuff. Yeah, I called him a Jeb Bush equivalent last time as a bit. He does deserve more respect.
Yeah, he was a conqueror, you know, Napoleon. He was a, well, what did we talk about just before? He was like a, we were talking about the warlords and bands of brothers. He kind of did that whole bit, didn't he? Like rise, he was a gamer and he rose up. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be hard to cover this part because my overarching recommendation for all of it is if you don't read the entirety of the book, or if you get it, you know, and you're not sure where to start, just start by reading part four. It's got so much to take away. I really struggled to find any kind of quotes or things that I really want to talk about directly, because all of it is worthy of being covered in a fair bit of detail.
Yeah, I found the whole book kind of flowed on, and it was like it built up towards the end without a peak. Like the end was the peak, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It just builds up constantly. And I think even if you were to read it for the first time, you might even struggle with the first, I don't know however many pages, like maybe the first just under a quarter of the book.
Yeah.
And then once you break through that bit, as it continues to build up, you do get, as Democ said, it's a page turner. But particularly after reading kind of maybe the prologue and most of the first section.
Yeah.
You almost can't put it down.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely found that. There's some other points we can maybe dive into about this. So he talks about kind of trying to make efforts to action in our times or organization and that kind of stuff, which are all really good and really pragmatic stuff. And he talks about choosing role models or looking to people in public life that have actually been successful in what they've done. So not, you know, being a LARPer or going for people with sort of overly abstract ideals or, you know, basically compromising themselves and fed posting left and right and, you know, easily being doxxed because they're heading out to marches without really thinking about what they're doing and that sort of stuff. He's like, that's all just simply a distraction from the central game. You need to look at what the people who have been effective have done and the way that they've conducted themselves on the way up to success and sort of do that, you know. It's pretty interesting, I guess. I took it as a bit of rebuke for a lot of the stuff that, you know, all of us may at one time or another thought, ah, it'd be cool if you could just do that, or if you didn't have to worry about this or that part of your life, you could just jump in both feet. And he sort of contextualizes it and said, well, actually, that's a huge own goal. What you should be maybe thinking more about is, like he was talking about with the movie thing, you know, maybe think about, he refers to this concept, or not concept, sorry, refers to this historical phenomenon of the samizdat, which is the like house press or the informal press in under Soviet rule, where people basically were the sort of Cold War era shit posters and pre-Cold War, making copies of books that were subversive against the ruling regime, you know, parodying and making light of power and the structures above them. And that's pretty much identical to what, you know, the great meme war looked like and still continues to be. So do those sort of things instead. And also, you know, points at the power that was demonstrated by none other than the internet terrorist known as 4chan. Did you have anything on that, Damon?
Yeah, he slammed every single major intelligence agency and said, nah, 4chan's better at this than you, which I'm not going to counter-signal and say he's right, not that I see much of the intelligence agency's work.
Mm.
4chan has done some impressive intelligence work in its time.
Mm.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we've spoken with people from Syria General before who somehow managed to get ISIS coordinates to the US military.
Jesus.
Just from their selfies.
Wow.
Similar stuff to that He Will Not Divide Us thing where they managed to find... what was that actor's name again?
Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, they got Shia LaBeouf's flags every time because they were good enough to trace plane routes, check weather forecasts, you know, soil water content.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the last flag they did was like, it was like a camera aiming up at the flag post. All you could see was the, like, you couldn't see anything other than what was at the top of the flag post. And yeah, didn't they? They fully like found it just by flight paths. And then they took it down and put the put like a Make America Great Again hat up on the mast or whatever. Pretty impressive little operation.
So he also points people in this part towards, you know, if you're thinking about the military, it's not might not be a terrible idea, but it's going to be tricky for you for reasons that we might imagine, not only the obvious difficulties because the military is, you know, demanding and all the rest of it, but also because of the structural difficulties and the concerns with modernity that all of us might think you'd face. But yeah, he says that it's not the worst thing, and he kind of goes through, I guess, all the, you know, decent and right talking points, like the demographics stuff. So talking about, you know, breeding rates and yada yada and trying to settle down and build a family, he kind of gives that fairly short shrift and says that it's not necessarily the way forward, or it's not going to work in and of itself. You know, he says, by all means, go for it, but it's not the golden bullet or silver bullet, sorry. Yeah. So did, kind of moving through almost to the end here, what, do you have any other kind of other closing takes or takeaways from this?
Ultimately closed it with the idea that this Leviathan will fall sooner or later. And when that happens, that they're not getting grip on the outer fringes of the world there. All the lads are going to be like shacking up in the Pacific Islands, buying up old oil rigs, stumping up mercenary bands. We're going to make Outer Heaven from Metal Gear Solid real.
Yeah.
Going to be getting those 4chan intelligent agents guys with connections all across the underworld. Going to be a hell of a time. It's basically going to be Metal Gear Solid, but real, apparently. That's how
we're in it. So I might finish up with a quote on this part. That's something that I sort of stuck out to me. So this is from under 77 in part 4. Says, quote, I see a time soon when a few men, maybe no more than a few hundred in the whole nation, or spread out over the whole world, will embark on the mission of the great downgoing. I have praised instinct many times in this book, but life on the ascent must can follow instinct. Whereas if you feel yourself to be a decadent, it's very important to resist instincts that lead to pointless self-destruction. Discipline and excellence are best when they come from your own desires, not from repression. But if your instincts lead you instead to self-debasing behaviors that will hurt you, by all means resist. Just understand that this path is at most a makeshift. We should want to give birth to beings who follow the higher path in life as a matter of innate blood and desire, not out of duty. Having to spend time and spiritual energy trying to repress destructive desires is difficult and expensive. Discipline is most important, but it matters where it comes from. End quote. So I think that sort of puts a bow on the attitudes or habits, at least the pragmatic mind frame that he tries to push forward in this. There's also a really neat summary in this part of the book, so he does wrap it up fairly well. There is a structure to it. did you two have any other closing takes on this?
Yeah. Overall, it was a fantastic read, I do have to say.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also very much a sort of product of its time and the time that we're in. And not only because he's talking about modern phenomena and the rest of it, but also because of the fact that it's written by somebody who made their name as, you know, an anonymous Twitter handle.
Yeah.
And is now seemingly one of the people at the forefront of the, you know, dissident right or third position zeitgeist, and I'm writing what amounts really to a manifesto about how people should consider putting their lives together in the wake of understandings on that side of things.
Yeah, well, he probably has like the, he must have probably the biggest Twitter account of any kind of dissident right personality, mustn't he? Him and I guess maybe who has his, an account as big? I guess Richard Spencer still has his verified account. But he has a huge account. It's 200,000 followers, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
No, I don't know. I could go and check it out. I mean, I know it's the article that you were talking about just before, the sort of neocons that talking to or referring to it. That's definitely, he's got traction within the mainstream media as well.
Yeah. A lot of that comes from, I think, as well, is his support from Metris Moldbug.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, reaction movement, yeah. I believe it was Moldbug who recommended the book to Michael Anton.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, I think that kind of gives him a little bit of sway as well, because Moldbug is, like, not establishment, but he's an established kind of novel thinker, dissident thinker, you could say. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think true. The did you have any sort of other criticisms or closing takes to Mark?
The only criticism I really have to offer off the top of my head would be that I disagree with most of his takes on art, but I think that's mostly just I get the feeling that he's using a little bit of intellectual thought to justify what is just his taste there. Otherwise, I don't have a lot of criticisms for the book. Quite liked it.
Yeah, so if you want to check the book out for yourself, obviously, as we talked about in the intro, you can get it on Amazon. There's lots of other places you can get it. and his Twitter is, I think we said at the beginning, but it's at Bronze Age Mantis. And he's got 25,700 followers at last count, so definitely no, that's all right. I mean, it's no slouch, it still had a two in it, I suppose. Yeah. That counts. And yeah, I think that there's some other places, his podcast, as we talked about, Caribbean Rhythms, you can check that out. He's now got a sort of subscription service, so he's doing a bit of a thing where I think the back like hour or 40 minutes of his show is paywalled, which is understandable. I suppose he's got to make a buck like everyone else if he's going to keep traveling the world and, you know, spending time on beaches and in dodgy nightclubs.
True.
Next round, yeah. Right, we're just going to paywall the outtakes, so you get to hear us taking coffee breaks and talking shit about each other while someone else is on coffee break.
Yeah, that's what we're going to paywall in future, for sure. So yeah, I think that's probably it for this episode, unless we have anything else. As we said, no call to action or whatever this time, because pretty much the whole book is. But the call to action is to go and check it out, at least read part four. If you don't do that, try and get a bit more sun and lift some weights. I think that's what Bap would say, right?
That's right, yeah. Pirate
movie. Perfect. All right, well, we'll catch you, dear listeners, next time on the show. And don't forget about getting in touch with us on Telegram. You can search for the show there and join in the chat by hitting, is it the chat or the discuss button in our channel, Bronze?
I think it's discuss, yeah. So you hit join on the channel and then there'll be a discuss button. There'll be a mute button and a discuss button. And you just hit the discuss button. Don't worry about the other one.
And if you want to send us some fan mail, hate mail, email, physique pictures, whatever, then you can fire those along to rootsoftheright@protonmail.com. But in the meantime, don't do anything stupid, and we'll see you for the next one. Thank you.